What is up, Central Coast Podcast listeners? It's me, Avi Becker, and I just wanted to say thank you so much for tuning into this second episode. I think you guys are really going to love it. The guest I have for this episode is a perfect mix of business and environmentalism, and he kind of blends two things that you might not think would go together traditionally, which is venture capitalism and environmental protection in action. So I really am excited to see what you guys think and would love to always hear about feedback. And enjoy this episode. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second episode of the Central Coast Podcast. I'm your host, Avi Becker, and sitting across from me, I have a really cool guy who I'm really excited to get to know better. We have my dude, Jackson Scher. Not Scher, don't be confused. It's Jackson Scher.
I've been dealing with Scher my whole life, so it's all good.
I got it right. So Jackson is an investment analyst at Alante Capital, and Alante isn't your average VC firm. They specialize in specifically funding the sustainable apparel supply chain. And I'm definitely going to let him explain that because I can only kind of understand that at a surface level, and he's going to be breaking that down way more. But Jackson, how are we doing today?
Doing well, man. I've been digging into a particular company that we're pretty excited about. Had a nice call with them yesterday and working on the memo today, so things are rocking and rolling.
Yeah, busy days at work, it sounds like.
Busy days, man, but that's what you want.
That's awesome. Well, Jackson works here at the Sandbox, and we're actually coming live from the Sandbox podcast room. So I got to meet Jackson, a couple months ago? We kind of just started chatting and talking about his business, and we had a lot in common, and I thought he'd be a perfect person for a podcast, a total business expert, but not just a business for money guy. He's a business for the environment kind of guy.
Yeah, I think you were wearing a Patagonia t-shirt on your first day, which you're wearing a Patagonia t-shirt right now. and so we started talking, but I was here first, man.
It's true.
I haven't been here long, but I was here first.
It's true, but I think I've taken over, so.
I think that's true.
You have seniority, but I'm climbing the ladder. I'm coming for you. Okay.
Well, you actually work at the Sandbox, so
exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, Jackson, to start things off, I know that you're not a Santa Barbara native, but how long have you been here for?
I've been in Santa Barbara since February, so just about 6 months, maybe seven.
Nice. And so I wanted to start it off with saying, I asked this question to my last guest too, but it's different. Obviously, he was born and raised here. So how do you describe Santa Barbara to maybe friends or family back home who have never been here? How do you kind of paint the picture of what Santa Barbara is to them?
Yeah, so I think a lot of people in Santa Barbara take for granted the fact that the beach is in their backyard.
Yeah.
My friends in Washington and in Boston and New York do not take that for granted. So I'm just like, oh yeah. So I basically just bike down to the beach whenever I want, and they just kind of look at me with this dumb sort of like, what? And then I say, and by the way, it's a 15-minute drive to the trailhead into the lower Sierras. Mm-hmm. So it's amazing to be squeezed between mountains and ocean, and the fact that it's mid-70s year-round doesn't hurt. So
yeah. Do you have a lot of jealous friends back home?
A lot of jealous friends from a matter of the topography and the climate. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Have any of them come out to visit?
Yeah, actually, just a couple weeks ago, two of my good buddies from Washington, D.C., my friends Dave and Liz, they visited my girlfriend Carolyn and
nice.
I. It was super fun. They were, the whole time, they were just eating fresh fish and going on hikes in the mountains, walking on the beach after work, and they were just like, what is this?
Yeah.
This is insane. So
yeah.
It was fun to show them around.
That's awesome. I've had a couple of my friends from Boulder, where I grew up, come mm-hmm. out and visit. I still remember the first time I kind of showed them around and showed them a spot, took them surfing. Went to got tacos and beers after, and it was just like, I'm just smiling like, yep, this is my day-to-day life. It's
yep,
vacation every day. Yeah, so let's take me back to where you're originally from. I know you're on the East Coast, but I don't know specifically mm-hmm. where. Where are you from originally?
Yeah, so I was born in New York City, but
okay.
pretty quickly moved to Pleasantville, New York, which is a suburb just north of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents are still living there, so I was living in Westchester County all through high school, and then I went to college at Williams College, which is in...
I thought of my notes.
Yeah, nice.
Did some digging.
Hit me up on LinkedIn today.
Yeah, exactly.
So I went to Williams College, which is in northwestern Massachusetts,
nice.
In Williamstown, Massachusetts. So not much around there besides mm-hmm. the school, but it was a super small school in the mountains. I had a ton of fun, made some really close friends. Right after school, after a little quick stint on the Pacific Crest Trail, I moved to Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
To go work with Axion International on their Frontier Investments Group, which eventually became Quona Capital. and we can get into how that happened if you want.
Totally. Well, let's start a little bit earlier. How did you always have a kind of a knack for the VC world? Did that come naturally to you, or how did you kind of get into that maybe in high school or college? How did that take place?
Yeah, good question. I started college in 2010, sort of right in the wake of the financial crisis.
Yeah.
I learned pretty quickly that I was good at thinking about things from an economic standpoint. I was doing well in Econ 101 and 201. And stuff like that. So I was excited about exploring it. And I took a class with Professor Bradbird, who it ended up that my boss at Axione had Professor Bradbird when she was at Williams, like many, many years prior.
Yeah.
And that was a two-person class. It was me, one other student, and Professor Bradbird. Williams does this thing called the tutorials where they do classes with a professor and two students. It's kind of like,
how many people go to Williams?
2,200 total. Okay. Yeah. So, and no grad students besides like this tiny art history program, which is great.
Yeah,
but so it was me, this woman, and Professor Bradbury. I'm forgetting the name of the girl who's in my class, but I was a sophomore, and it was called Water as a Scarce Resource.
Wow.
So it was an economics class that married a lot of environmental studies side of things. And we were able to just dive into some of these issues because it was just the two of us. There's no room to hide when there's two students and a professor.
Can't sit in the back of class with two people in the class, right?
You can't skip class. You can't not have done the reading. You can't not have done the homework, you know.
Wow.
So I learned a lot there and kind of from then said, okay, I'm excited about this. I'm excited about using economics for something positive. You know, it's not all Wall Street. It's not all bad. And so I started learning more about microfinance and the world of impact. And I went to India for my fall of my junior year. And I studied in Pune. And I was able to do a lot of work on development economics there. I actually took a short internship with a microfinance group, just tooling around to self-help group microfinance meetings, riding my translator's motorcycle every day as this like crazy white guy who's asking like, what do you use this money for? Yeah, it was super fun to see it on the ground.
Yep.
It was local groups of 8 to 15, you know, urban women that were saving money for the first time thanks to microfinance. So when I left school, I was excited about working in economics for good, broadly defined.
Yeah.
And I ended up at Axione, which is a large microfinance nonprofit, and there was a role at the Frontier Investments Group, and I kind of didn't know a ton about that, but I was looking for any way in the door. It was a cool organization doing great work. You know, I had no skills. So I ended up kind of learning more along the interview process and realized that they were investing in startups bringing financial services to the underserved globally. So it was sort of microfinance 2.0, beyond microfinance is what they used to call it. So we moved into the world of fintech, financial technology, and I kind of woke up 3 months in being like, wait, I work in finance.
What happened like that.
Yeah, so I never anticipated working in finance.
Wow.
You know, I never anticipated, mainly because I just equated finance with Wall Street.
Yep.
That
was
really
never who you were. You knew you were never going to go that economic route.
Right, that was not going to be me. And I have friends that do it and love it.
Yeah.
So no harm there. But
totally.
I was always thinking about sort of the double bottom line, the profit and the purpose. But sort of one day realized that we were investing in really great stuff. And we were investing in stuff that was helping people and making money. It was a sustainable way to create impact instead of asking for donations and grants on an annual cycle like a nonprofit. We were investing in profitable companies that were doing really good work. And so I dove pretty far into the impact investing world. About a year and a half into my time at Axione, that group that I was on, the Frontier Investments Group, spun off into our own fund, and that became Quona Capital. It was the same team, same strategy, but we raised money from outside investors, and so we couldn't exist as a nonprofit anymore because we weren't them. But Axione was sort of the incubator, the big supporter. They invested a lot of money, and we moved our offices right next door. So it was still a very close relationship. But
we were in the
impact investing world, and I left after a little while. It was just sort of time to do something new, and I'm excited to be continuing to work in impact investing with Elante.
Yeah, totally. Before we get into Elante, I just want to talk about how, like, for me, going abroad in college was one of the most impactful things I've done, and just, like, getting to see the world on a bigger macro scale and how, you know, like other countries. I went to Australia, so it was definitely out to Sydney. It was different than India, I bet.
Yeah.
But still, just meeting those other cultures and those other people, it's, you know, it's like it takes you kind of a little bit away from the America-centric viewpoint mm-hmm. that you're taught for so many years about money, America, like, you know, just do whatever it takes for America. And it's like we're all in this together kind of feel. And there's obviously, when I went to Sydney and Australia is super environmentally focused, like we are here in California. But it just kind of reinforced that. And it's like, okay, let's think about work, you know, at a global scale. And mm-hmm. it sounds like you really got that too in India. Did it really just open your mind to a whole new level of, you know, global force?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, India is a fascinating place. The program that I was on was all about modern India and how it reconciles with ancient India. You know, you go to these temples that have been around for thousands of years, but the young people at school at Ferguson College are as cosmopolitan as you or I. So, you know, it's this amazing sort of mash of cultures, mash of tradition with new economic forces, with the internet is a huge deal, obviously. The internet's a shocking revelation from Jackson. The internet's a huge deal. No, but like the young people interact with the world in such a different way that their parents and grandparents do. And so it's really interesting to see how traditions are preserved while things are sort of innovating and evolving locally. So it was a really eye-opening experience, definitely. Definitely has influenced sort of what I've done since.
Yeah. So I think the message you're getting from both of us, if you're still in college and haven't gone abroad,
do it.
Go as far away as you can.
Yeah. Just go. Just go somewhere different and you'll come back knowing more about who you are.
Yeah, totally. Like you can always go to like Spain with all your friends, but India or Thailand or Australia with no one you know, that you might want to think about that. Well, yeah. So you were starting to talk about how you found Elante. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know at all how you maybe you might have told me briefly, but I don't remember. How did you contact them or they contact you or how did that all play out?
My friends in D.C., when they hear this, they'll know that I had been networking for about a year.
Sliding in the LinkedIn DMs or what?
Doing my best to slide in the LinkedIn DMs. And every month, LinkedIn would send me a notification like, hey, you should really buy a pro subscription because you're coming up on your search limit. And I was like, oh, it's the 28th? I'll be all right. I networked hard. Impact investing is a small community. There are not a lot of mid to low level experience positions. There are a few entry level and everything else is like, you know, post MBA. So it was challenging, but I had really built a strong network at Axion and Aquona. And so I think the day that Leslie, who's one of the partners at Elante, posted on LinkedIn, we need an analyst, and it was, you know, 2 to 4 years of experience, which was perfect. I think I had 3 different people like send that post to me, and I said to all of them, like, I've already seen it, don't worry. But the real link in between all of us is this woman, Amy Bell, who was at JP Morgan and helped JP Morgan to invest in Quona. And actually, Amy Bell introduced Leslie and Carla, the other partner at Elante, to each other. And I know Amy Bell from my time at Quona. I reached out to her, said, hey, you know, this looks like an amazing opportunity. She said, oh, this would be perfect. I'll know all 3 of the people at Elante. I had a great first interview with Carla. I remember walking away from that, what ended up being like an hour long interview, just being like, that was amazing. You know, so glad to speak to someone who really, and she and I thought about things in a very similar way. It felt great. Mm-hmm. The process took a while, as things do, but it definitely felt like it was meant to be in a lot of ways.
That's so cool. And so, after that process, you were probably offered the job like on the spot. And did you just pull the trigger right away? Or did you think about, damn, I'm about to head out across the coast, leave my friends and family, and change things up big time?
Yeah. I had been unemployed for a year, which at the end of a year, you're sort of pretty psyched to take the next job.
Got you, for sure.
Not to say that I wouldn't have otherwise. I love what I do.
Yep.
But I had been in the interview process with Elante for a while, mainly because they were sort of closing some capital and couldn't hire anyone until they did that. And so I was interviewing in November and I ended up starting in March. So I had a lot of time to think about, is this really what I want to do? But I kind of just said, you know what, this job sounds amazing. This seems like an opportunity to build something real. I'm going to have a lot of responsibility. I'm going to get to learn and grow. Santa Barbara does sound nice. I don't know anyone there, but, you know, let's go for it. And I want to shout out my girlfriend here for kind of bearing with that. She's a teacher. She's an English teacher. She was teaching at the Field School in Washington, D.C., and she said, you know what, let's go for it.
Wow.
And she managed to get herself a job at the Ojai Valley School, which is just down the road from here. So we're pretty psyched to have made this move together across the country.
Yep.
We were remote for a little while, but, you know, that's okay. And we're pretty psyched to be out here. But yeah, it's definitely a change, definitely different than Washington, D.C., that's
yeah,
for sure.
That's awesome. I didn't know she moved out here with you. I thought originally maybe you met her out here or something. Shout out. Big shout out.
Shout out to Carolyn, yeah.
That's awesome. And so one question I had was, is there a specific time you can remember maybe a failure or maybe a setback or maybe getting totally rejected in the LinkedIn DMs that maybe like allowed you to find this opportunity at Elante and has really set you up and maybe allowed you to become who you are today and allowed you to be so successful at your job?
I mean, the job interview process is just filled with failures. All it is failures because you only get one success.
True.
But I think for a while, right after I left Quona, I was thinking, you know, I've done the investing thing. I want to do the more business operations thing. I want to go work for one of the startups that we invested in or that type of company. And I think that when I was told no by some of these other companies, I kind of took a step back and said, you know, what do I love about what I did? What do I want to do in the future? And I kind of realized that impact investing has been sort of was there all along. And I felt like I was running away from it just for the sake of doing something new, even though I really enjoyed that. So about, you know, a few months into that process, I started to sort of reconfigure and started having a lot more success, probably because my skills actually matched the job description. But, you know, I think that, yeah, being told no and sort of having to take a step back and saying kind of, okay, let me game plan a little bit more deliberately and think about kind of what it is that's important in this next step definitely helped me to hold out, I guess, until the Elante job was posted and all, yeah, everything came together.
That's cool. Yeah, I definitely feel like I've done that before too, where you maybe shy away from something you've been doing for a while and then you can come back to it and be like, this is actually what I really love to do. And it's okay to stay in the same position or field or skill set if you really love it and it's what you're good at. Maybe, yeah, those rejections from those other companies would maybe be a blessing in disguise because maybe you would be doing something you don't love as much as you do. And you might not be out here and you probably wouldn't be on this podcast. So
almost certainly would not be on this podcast. Yeah.
Blessing in disguise for my podcast, at least.
I remember being offered a job in Myanmar working.
Whoa.
Yeah. Working with a company that was bringing mobile money to places like Myanmar. Working with their mobile network operators, and it was a company that's based in South Africa. And I was on the Africa team at Quona. I was investing in African companies, and I just fell in love with Cape Town, the city. And I said, what do I have to do to get to Cape Town? And I got connected with this company through someone who was working at Quona. And they basically said, we want you to be in Myanmar. We want you to be the guy on the ground, and you'll be sort of Skyping in with your team in Cape Town periodically, and you know, you'll pretty much be alone in Myanmar doing really interesting work. And I just said, holy smokes, like, I don't know about that. And I sort of thought about my daily day-to-day and said no to the job and realized I didn't have anything in the fire, any embers, any irons in the fire at all at that point. And that was the day that I left for a trip to Patagonia with my good friend Dave.
Wow.
And so I got on the flight and being like, I just rejected a job and I have no other prospect. Let's go to the mountains.
That's epic. And I don't know if would your girlfriend be down to move to Myanmar? Probably not.
Oh, no. No.
Yeah, that's a little Santa Barbara. That's far enough. I mean, I can't imagine that would have been hell of an experience. You would have made it out, but I mean, I think you definitely made the right decision at the end of the day.
I think so. I think I'm much more able to kind of do what I'm good at here.
For sure. So yeah, let's talk about what you're good at. Let's talk about Elante. You like that transition?
That was nice. That was very smooth. You're a natural. This is what, your 200th episode?
No, nope, my second.
Sorry.
Let's talk about Elante. I want to learn more about what you guys do. Obviously, you invest in sustainable clothing, but let's hear about the kind of the vision of Elante and the projects you're working on. Obviously, there's probably some stuff you can't talk about. So
yeah,
let's just hear about what you're working on currently.
Definitely. So we are a VC firm. We're investing in young companies So either seed or Series A level companies, so companies that have been around for a while but aren't, you know, huge and also aren't two gals in a garage.
What's a Series A for those who aren't VC masters, by the way?
Sorry, yeah, you're right, the lingo. So seed is kind of the first amount of funding that a company will raise from sort of quote-unquote real investors, where before that they would sort of ask friends and family for some money and spend their own money. Seed is from real investors. Series A is the next round. And there's Series B, Series C, et cetera, all the way to IPO.
Nice, got it.
Which is when everyone gets super rich. So basically, we're looking at young companies, and they are in three sectors within this world of sustainable apparel. And you'll notice none of them are selling clothes. There's the production side, which is different raw materials, things like making leather out of mushrooms or making polyester yarn, biodegradable polyester yarn substitute out of methane gas. And then also kind of right-sizing production. So thinking about if we make 10 shirts, sell 6 of them, and throw 4 of them into a landfill, how about we make 6? And how can we get to a better sort of matching between production and actual sales? So there's some software technology for that. In distribution, thinking about shipping and packaging, thinking about sort of on-demand and things like that. So everything that takes clothing from fulfillment center to end user, end person, you and I, that's a huge industry in itself, even though that's not the process of making apparel.
Yeah, it was maybe the reason they decided not to invest in those, because it seems like there's so many specific companies that are green-focused clothing, obviously led by Patagonia, but do they feel like that space was just kind of crowded and this space could have more impact, or they could have more impact on?
Yeah, I think the decision not to invest in brands is definitely based on a couple of things. We don't want to be taking fashion risk. We don't want to be saying what we think is cool and what we think is not cool. That's not our focus. It's certainly not my focus.
You're wearing a cool shirt. I don't know. I think you could do it.
I think Leslie and Carlo would be a lot better equipped to make fashion judgments than I would.
Yeah.
Yeah, he says. No, but basically what we're saying is actually that these innovations can hit the whole supply chain and have a real impact outside of just one brand. So Patagonia is a phenomenal company and a real pioneer and a leader in a lot of this stuff. They're a billion-dollar company. The materials that they use to make their sort of environmentally friendly clothing, those can be used by other companies. And so Patagonia will often push something to market, and then other companies will sort of go from there. And there's this whole list of companies that support Patagonia and are suppliers of really great materials for those guys. So we love Patagonia. They're in Ventura. We talk to their investing team quite often. But no, we're not looking for the next Patagonia. We're looking for the next supplier to a company like that.
Yeah, that's amazing. And yeah, shout out Patagonia for sure. They're the goats. So one question I had as well is, were you always kind of an avid environmentalist or always intrigued by environmental issues specifically, or did that kind of grow through your process of learning, or how that happen?
Before I answer that, I realize I only talked about 2 out of the 3 sectors. So the last one is waste recovery. So if there's a way to avoid sending something to a landfill, we would love to be able to do that either with resale or repair, and then eventually recycling. So we're looking at a few companies that are chemically recycling cotton poly blended textiles and being able to turn that into a dissolving pulp that can be turned back into new clothing. So more of a closed loop solution.
That's amazing.
Which is pretty cool.
I bet you know the stats on like how many billions of pounds of clothes are thrown in the trash. You got any fun statistics for us?
I don't have any fun statistics, man. It's enough. It's a lot.
Yeah.
I could look up a report that I do have on my hard drive, but the numbers are big and they're scary.
Maybe the statistic is don't shop at H&M, right?
The statistic is if you buy something, wear it. Wear it more than once, wear it more than 5 times, and if it's, you know, not wearable because it's not cool, find a better use for it than throwing it in the trash. And repair your stuff. You know, if you have a jacket that you love and it breaks, don't throw it out.
Mm-hmm.
Put a little patch on it, you know. So totally. I think there's this world of fast fashion right now, and it's because we buy stuff that's cheaply made, and it's on trend for a minute, and then we throw it out. And that's where the waste comes in. You know, Patagonia, you've had that shirt probably for a long time. It's going to last you for a long time. And if it gets a rip in it, you can bring it to Worn Wear and they'll put a patch on it and send you back on your way. Why buy a new shirt? So I think from a consumer standpoint, yeah, just trying to buy less stuff and use the stuff we have and make it last.
Yep. Is really the sorority girls at UCSB who buy something once for a party and throw it out. That was for you. So
I'm quickly realizing like who the audience of this podcast is.
We have a vast audience. We had almost 100 downloads on our last episode, and I think this one's going to be at 200 or 300.
Oh boy.
Yeah. But yeah, so let's talk about your environmental like mindset.
Yeah. So I've been environmentally minded my whole life. I mean, my family is big on getting outside. I went on hiking trips from a super, super early age. I was in the outdoor club at Williams. I, you know, went on a sort of Knowles style. It wasn't actually Knowles. It was a very similar style trip in high school. And, you know, that's one of the great things about being out here is the access to the outdoors. So I've been someone that's gone hiking and been in the oceans and gone biking my whole life, since for as long as I can remember. So it's amazing to be able to marry sort of skill set from an economic standpoint and a financial standpoint with actually knowing that the impact is really an environmental impact. It's one of the things I was missing when I was at Quona. We were doing amazing work. It was super important. But the financial inclusion story doesn't necessarily touch the environment in a direct way. So it's nice to be back into that world.
Yeah, and really that helps fuel your passion and helps you maybe on a day that's tougher, a long grind, you're remembering what you're fighting for probably, I bet.
Yeah, exactly.
And so coming from the East Coast, is the people here, are they different in terms of, are they more environmentally minded? Or I want to know what it's like on the East Coast. I've spent a little bit of time on the East Coast, mm-hmm. but is the community here, have you found to be more like you are? Or was there a big green movement on the East Coast?
Yeah, there's definitely folks are definitely conscious of the environmental movement on the East Coast, for sure. I think it manifests itself in different ways. I think that from what I've seen from living in Washington, D.C. especially, is that folks are pretty excited about policy initiatives and ways forward and don't necessarily have the day-to-day touch and feel of in the environment. We're out here, especially in Santa Barbara. I mean, that's easy. You'd have to ask someone from LA and see if that's really true in a big city. But in Santa Barbara, it's so tangible. It's so physical. It's like, save the ocean because I live there. So I've definitely seen a little bit more proactive action out here, whereas out on the East Coast, in the places where I've lived, it's a lot more systems oriented. I think those are both good ways to go about
doing
things. But yeah, I would say that's the biggest difference. But that might just be going from specifically Washington, which is all policy, to specifically Santa Barbara, which is physically here.
Yeah, but no, those are both good kind of differences that both play a very important role. Mm-hmm. You have to submerge yourself in it to really fight for it in the government. And obviously you want to create change through the government, and the government's a great way to create change. I don't know, listeners who aren't from Santa Barbara, are we the first city to ban straws? Or no, maybe. But we're just jumping on the straw bandwagon.
That's right.
In December. And I mean, policy is really important because a lot of companies aren't as cool as Elante, and they're not going to fight for the environment, and they're going to fight for their bottom line a little bit harder. But it takes the people to force those companies that aren't fighting for the environment to have to do these things like straw banning. And obviously, that's a small start, but there's a long way to go. And that kind of transitions me into, are there any specific, being an environmental expert, if you will, you know this stuff pretty well, are there any specific issues that you're really looking at and fighting for, or just really curious about how we're going to fix?
Yeah, right now, especially in the work we're doing at Elante, we're thinking a lot about plastics in the ocean, and we're thinking about how we can avoid that in any way. There's definitely a process of pulling plastics out of the ocean. That's not really the actual part of the issue that we're touching. We're thinking about when things are made, can they be made in a biodegradable way so they don't collect on the ocean? We need people to pull plastic out of the ocean, for sure. That's not us. We're thinking about in the production side, can we make things that are biodegradable? And then on the distribution side, can we make things that are reusable? So even if you use recycled cardboard, because the demand for cardboard boxes is increasing every year as Amazon, et cetera, get larger and larger, your average cardboard box is about 40% recycled cardboard. What's great is that about 92% of cardboard boxes are recycled at the end, but there's such a high demand sort of at the production that we still only get to use about 40% materials. If we have a shipper that is reusable, you know, you buy something from Patagonia, they send it to you, you send the package back, and Patagonia uses that again. Now we don't have waste at all. Now we don't have we have reuse, which is even better than recycling.
Yeah, I haven't seen are those available now, or are those packages?
Yeah, there's three companies that we know of that are making reusable packaging, and we're kind amazing. Of glancing at all of them.
You always think of, oh, I'm just gonna buy this package, recycle it, and it's gonna go back, but it's the demand is growing, and just by having it something that you use once and then recycling to something else, there's a whole way to do a better way than that, it sounds like.
Yeah. And then the last big issue that we're working on right, like this month, you know, if things change as we see new innovations, is we're looking at those chemical recycler companies and trying to say, you know, if a cotton poly blended t-shirt is headed towards a landfill, is there a way to, if it's really shredded and can't be repaired and can't be resold or anything, if it's really shredded, is there a way to, instead of putting that in a landfill, especially the poly section will just sort of never decompose, the cellulosic content, which is the cotton, will at least be something that's in nature, but it's still just going to sit in a landfill. Is there a way to shred those down into dissolving pulp and polyester monomers and sort of push those back up in the supply chain as raw materials towards making more things and sort of create this closed loop economy, which is avoiding the landfill, which is the goal.
That's amazing. Do you think that kind of stuff, like how far out do you think we are from this, like being reasonable? Like, do you think this stuff is going to come soon? And obviously with as more companies like you and as your company kind of leads the charge, it sounds like this will become more and more a reality with some money and with the consumers starting to demand more.
Yeah.
But when do you think this kind of stuff will be available
in
the mass market?
It's going to take some money, and it's going to take some time for brands to kind of pilot things and make sure it works in their supply chain. You can't ask a brand to totally revamp their supply chain in order to make this regenerative, you know, apparel. So these companies are having to work with brands and make sure what they're building works with the existing systems, existing solvents, existing spinning processes, etc. But I think you're going to see regenerated clothing on the market mid to late 2019. And you're going to see it sort of mass market, hopefully, if all things go well at either one of the companies that we invest in or one of their competitors, I suppose, 2020, 2021.
So soon.
It's not far.
Yeah, that's really soon. That's right around the corner. That's awesome. And so if people are listening and they want to follow any of these, do you have any specific companies that you like to watch right now? Or I don't know what you're allowed to say if you've invested, but if there are any companies that people should go check out that you recommend right now or different people you're working with?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard for an individual consumer to like say, I want to buy a shirt from regenerated, you know, cotton, because they're not on the market yet. And if I told you the names of the companies that are trying to make it, you'd sort of look at them and be like, oh, they're super cool, but I can't, like, they don't make shirts. So,
yeah, so let's finish off this podcast with a little more Santa Barbara talk. I know, so you've been here for a little bit less than a year, but you got any favorite spots or any kind of go-to Santa Barbara locations that you just love?
Yeah, Hendry's Beach after work, especially on a Friday. Just go on a walk, see all the dogs.
Yep.
Always nice.
Jump in the water, maybe?
Jump in the water. Depends if I brought a bathing suit to work, which here at the Sandbox, you never know. let's see. Gotta love the farmer's market Saturday mornings. And then Carolyn and Jackson's Kitchen after a trip to the Santa Barbara farmer's market is always great. And then we've got Telegraph Brewing Company right around the corner from the Sandbox. We were just there last night. So they make some really interesting sour beers, some really interesting IPAs. It's just a cool vibe over there. So it's nice that there are all these little microbreweries. There's Topa Topa, Third Window, Telegraph, Figaro Mountain. It's super fun. So I'm a big beer guy. So it's really fun to be able to go to those spots.
Yeah, we're going to have to grab a beer maybe after this.
Sounds good to me, man.
So wrapping things up, man, it was awesome having you on the podcast. And if people want to reach out to you or learn more about what you guys are working on or what's coming up next for Elante, is there a good place to find you?
Yeah, we're on Twitter at Elante Capital, and we have a website, elantecapital.com. And I think the contact us goes directly to my inbox because we're a three-person team and I'm the analyst. So that's life right now.
Send them lots of questions, guys. Just ask them how his day's going. Flood that inbox.
Sounds good.
Awesome. Jackson, I really appreciate you having you on this podcast and you spreading light and knowledge. You're a really awesome clothing expert, and I'm really excited to see where Elante goes and excited to see how your picks goes with different companies, and hopefully by 2021 we'll be wearing stuff that you've been talking about, and we'll say, hey, he brought that up on the podcast 2 years ago. Yeah. You guys are late.
That's when this podcast is huge, and everyone's like, oh, that's where it started. Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, Avi. It's been a lot of fun.
Of course, man. Take care.
Cheers.
Hope you guys enjoyed that second ever episode of the Central Coast Podcast. I think it's heating up. I think we got something here. Maybe we'll get 101 downloads this time. Only one way to find out. But as always, feel free to reach out to me at avi.becker3@gmail.com for any insights or anything you'd like to share with me. And keep grinding, everyone. Keep saving the planet. And I'm going to keep pushing out some good content. We got good things in the works. Big guests coming on. So stay tuned for more episodes. Have a great rest of your day.